I'm Josh Hammer.
I'm Emily Jashinsky.
I'm Ben Weingarten.
And I'm Rachel Bovard.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common sense and common good meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcast. So we have today probably an even, I would hazard a guess, say an even wider ranging show than usual. And our shows are usually pretty wide ranging. So we're going to start off with Rachel talking about the latest out of Silicon Valley. We've got this Jack Dorsey resignation. What does it mean? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it somewhere in between? I will have the final of what seems like an interminable strand of segments about the Dobbs abortion case at the Supreme Court. Then we're going to go to Emily's going to talk about the Omicron variant, the panic surrounding that. And then we're going to wrap up with Ben talking about the future of Taiwan and all the recent military action in the Taiwan Straits. But let's kick it off with Rachel. So tell us what's going on with Jack Dorsey and Twitter, Rachel.
Yeah, so we are recording this on a Tuesday. On Monday of this week, Jack Dorsey announced he was stepping down as the CEO of Twitter, which he has headed up for the last 16 years. This was something of a surprise, although not necessarily, because he's also been heading up Square, which is sort of the credit card processing website and company, and he's been focusing a lot of attention on that. So he announces he's stepping down, and he's going to be replaced by a guy named Parag Agrawal, and he has been currently serving as the CTO of Twitter. He's taking over as CEO. And this sparked a lot of concern among Silicon Valley watchers, especially those of us on the right who are concerned with, you know, how Twitter's already been cracking down on speech. It looks like Agrawal is going to be potentially even worse at cracking down on speech, given some very disturbing statements he's made in the past. A number of people were pointing to an interview that he gave last year, about a year ago, in November of 2020. In where he said, and I quote, "Our role is not to be bound by the First Amendment, but our role is to serve a healthy public conversation." And then he goes on to say, "The kinds of things that we do about this is focus less on thinking about free speech, but thinking about how the times have changed," end quote. Well, there's a lot to unpack in that sentiment, particularly how far I think Twitter has evolved. And I think all the social media companies have evolved. There were some takes on this yesterday that I saw from people on the right who were like, oh, Jack Dorsey's been like nominally good on free speech. You know, it's bad that he's leaving. Well, this was true of all of the founders of these social media companies. If you remember, as recently as 2019, Mark Zuckerberg gave a big speech at Georgetown University where he said, you know, we are going to, you know, always err on the side of free speech. Nobody wants a world in which, you know, speech is controlled by the tech companies. Well, you know, a couple of years later, those sentiments look quaint. And the same has been true for Jack Dorsey. He may actually be a founder, you know, that is conflicted about some of the moves his company has made. He's done nothing to stand up against them. He allowed the censorship of the Hunter Biden story. He's outsourced most of the content moderation policies of Twitter to a woman named Vijaya Gadde, who basically runs the content moderation policy at Twitter now. So how much of a role Jack Dorsey has really had in promoting his free speech values, I don't think at this point you can say it's been a significant role. So Twitter has definitely evolved in this direction. It sounds like this new CEO is going to take it even worse, in a worse direction. And it kind of goes to this broader meta narrative that we always talk about on the show, which is that these, you know, far from merely being private companies, these companies represent the major avenues of our public speech and engagement. It's not obviously just people talking to ourselves at this point. It is how politicians reach voters. It is how Donald Trump, I really do think, vaulted himself in many ways from sort of an outside candidate to a mainstream contender for the presidency and then the president of the United States, because Twitter allowed him a platform with which to speak forcefully and directly to the voters. So to see a CEO come to office with views that, you know, oh, the First Amendment is just sort of this ancillary issue that we don't really need to focus on that. It's reminiscent of the Facebook Oversight Board being like, oh, the First Amendment, that burdensome local ordinance, you know, that bothers us because we are not citizens of the United States. We are citizens of the world. And it's just more, I think, evidence to the fact that, you know, we actually do need some sort of either regulatory presence for these companies, or as I have long argued, an antitrust enforcement or competition policy that just decentralizes their control over speech and allows that those speech concerns to be competed away in a marketplace that I don't actually think exists in tech. So open to the room on where you think Twitter is going and if this, you know, ascension of the new CEO bodes ill or good things for conservatives.
So I've been baffled a little bit. Rachel, I'd be curious if it seems like you share my sense of baffling. I mean, I saw like Sagar and Jetty. I think Posobiec might have had a tweet out there basically saying that, you know, like this is like the end of free speech on Twitter. I mean, like these guys are friends of mine, but like I respectfully disagree. I mean, it's not like Twitter has been like a free speech, you know, ecosystem for years. I mean, you know, I was texting just yesterday with our, you know, our mutual friend, Mike Davis of Internet Accountability Project. I mean, Mike has, at least he told me, I mean, and, you know, I think this is probably a matter of public record at this point, that many people from Senate Judiciary Committee have apparently said to him that they have reason to believe that Jack Dorsey's been personally involved in some of the most kind of egregious content moderation decisions. I didn't ask for elaboration. I don't really know how much the public record on the specific incidents of that is out there, but look, Jack, let's remember who Jack Dorsey was. I mean, this guy donated, what, $10 million to like the Ibram X. Kendi Center for Anti-Racism at Boston University or something like that. I probably butchered the name there, but that's basically what the center entails. It's basically just an Ibram X. Kendi kind of slush fund of sorts. I mean, you literally just look at the guy. I mean, you could literally just look at the man when he appeared on Zoom testifying before Congress with like the Rasputin like hair. And I mean, like, you know, like the nose rings, the tats. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit here. This was not our friend, okay? And, you know, is a new guy going to be any better? I mean, probably not, to be honest with you. But Twitter, I think Rachel's right to underscore the fact that Twitter does occupy kind of like a unique spot in kind of the broader big tech debate. I think back to when I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, like a little over a month ago, debating Carl Szabo of NetChoice. And like, I opened my opening remarks by talking about how like the Silicon Valley are the new robber barons. And I basically said, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, and Google, excuse me, are the top five largest market caps. And then Carl immediately butts in and is like, okay, so we're stipulating right now that Twitter is not big tech. And like, it's okay, like this is like it's kind of a gotcha trick from Silicon Valley, because Twitter obviously is not as big, and they're not as big from a market cap perspective, because frankly, it's a really poorly run company. Like their monetization, like their basic kind of business fundamentals are just not there. But it does exercise disproportionate clout, because that's where the news cycle generates. That is kind of how the cable news, kind of how the reporters, the journos, all the talking class, the bi-coastal elites, that is where it happens, is right there on Twitter. So I think this change only does underscore, as Rachel says, the fact that we really do need more prudential regulation here, because we have no idea what we're getting. And as a basic matter, it is completely, completely anathema to basic self-governance norms to be in the dark as to where the new kind of public square will be held literally as soon as tomorrow or next week.
I'll jump in right here. First of all, I apologize for my setup. I'm at a pro-life event on the eve of the Dobbs arguments, which we'll talk about a little bit. But I just want to add, I think there's a little bit of like two things also can be true here, in that there's no reason to celebrate somebody who ran a platform that cancels people, deplatforms them for believing that they should be able to say biological men are biological men. There's nothing to be celebrated with a corporate platform that treats speech in that way, period. That's not good. And Jack Dorsey obviously oversaw that. And I'll add, it's a statement on how far we've fallen. Twitter is a small company. The most important thing to know about it, as I wrote in Federalist this morning, is that nobody uses it, which is both good and bad. It's good because it keeps people off another corporate dopamine manipulator, but it's bad because it means the few people that are on it are in a bubble, and the company is disproportionately powerful. And so under the new CEO, who says, you know, he believes that there's this dichotomy between a healthy public conversation, that's his quote, and the First Amendment. That's really interesting and important, because that's basically the governing philosophy of the left at this point. They believe that the spirit of the First Amendment, the legal and cultural norm, this sort of old ACLU, everything but incitement type standard for what free speech should be, is not healthy, that it is psychological violence. And that's what you're getting from the new Twitter CEO, but it was absolutely inevitable. And that's sad for a company that started and was run by somebody who was very anti centralization, was very excited and ambitious about decentralizing things with this company. So I think it's a statement on the arc of Silicon Valley itself.
I think those points are all well taken. If I'm a betting man, I'm betting that things will only get worse, but they're already bad to begin with. Just today, I believe, and we're recording this on Tuesday, there was a policy that came out on sort of censoring private media under the guise of protecting people. And I'll just read quickly from it. It says, this is new Twitter policy. When we're notified by individuals depicted or by an authorized representative that they did not consent to have their private image or video shared, we will remove it. This policy is not applicable to media featuring public figures or individuals when media and accompanying tweet text are shared in the public interest or add value to the public discourse. However, if the purpose of the dissemination of private images of public figures or individuals who are part of public conversations is to harass, intimidate, or use fear to silence them, we may remove the content in line with our policy against abusive behavior. Every part of this is subjective, of course. What constitutes tweet text shared in the public interest or what adds value to public discourse is, of course, being determined by none other than Twitter. And we know what Twitter feels about speech that is legitimate, speech that adds to the public discourse. It's speech that they condone because they believe it serves their narrative, and speech that does not serve their narrative, obviously, is speech that could, of course, be perceived as harmful. You can see how this could be used to shield all manner of public figures that Twitter wants to promote or not, or demote, as the case may be. So I just think that we're headed, and it's not just Twitter, by the way. Of course, there are all manner of elected representatives right up to the White House itself that has talked about working with big tech to combat, quote unquote, misinformation and disinformation, of course, as determined by our ruling class better. So we are so unmoored from what Section 230's preamble, the findings of Section 230 were about, which is, of course, promoting robust discourse and sharing of information. These are publishing companies, and they're publishing companies with a very specific mandate. And that mandate is to shove the official ruling class narrative down our throats. And I think it's in large part attributable to the Donald Trump effect, which was that having an unfiltered, unalloyed medium for anyone to share their opinions led to an electoral result that served as a near-death experience for the ruling class, or at least that's how it's perceived it. And consequently, that can never be allowed to happen again. And so I suspect we're only going further down this road to intellectual serfdom, to lack of free speech going forward in the big tech sphere. And that's where Twitter will be the leading edge, the tip of that spear.
Yeah, no, totally. Like I think we all said, Twitter is not as big, it's not as popular. It's just a worse business model, honestly, and then a lot of these other companies, but it does punch above its weight, so to speak. So we have to pay very close attention to obviously what happens next. But let's transition. So we're recording this on Tuesday. So tomorrow, from our perspective, I guess it'll probably be, in the past when the podcast is released, is the Dobbs abortion case. So we've spent a lot of time on this podcast and Dobbs case, and rightfully so. This is the biggest case of the Supreme Court in a very long time. I mean, at minimum since the first Obamacare case or the DC versus Heller of the gun case, probably honestly since the last major abortion case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey itself in 1992. So just to kind of bring us back all on the same speed here, Dobbs originates out of the state of Mississippi. Mississippi passes a 15-week basically just straight up abortion ban. There are limited dispensations, of course, for the life and health, life and drastic health of the mother after 15 weeks, but it's basically a standard 15-week ban. And the QP, the question presented to the court, is whether, quote, all pre-viability bans on abortion are constitutional, which effectively amounts to a direct challenge to Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which modified Roe versus Wade, but famously on flimsy at best stare decisis grounds kind of kept the crux of the Roe versus Wade decision. So there are really kind of four basic ways that this can go. And I want to do this real quickly because I actually want to get to judicial nominations in a little bit. The four basic ways that Dobbs can go, and we can talk about this a little bit if you guys want to, are, from my perspective, one, obviously it could just be a straight affirmance of the Fifth Circuit, which would mean that the Mississippi law is struck down. That's an utter disaster, obviously. The two kind of middle ground positions are, one, they could kind of say that the undue burden standard from Casey actually permits this law for XYZ reasons. The related third possibility is they could reformulate the Casey undue burden standard and just kind of concoct a new standard out of thin air. Both those options are intellectually disingenuous, but the court on abortion jurisprudence is nothing if not intellectually disingenuous. And then, of course, the final option that we're all hoping for is just a clean overruling of Roe and Casey. But for the purposes of this segment, because we've talked about all this on previous segments, I want to talk just a little bit about kind of what happens if this thing really goes wrong. And really going wrong, frankly, amounts to really any of the first three options. Because at this point, we really should all be kind of hoping, and I would argue fully expecting, a full clean overruling of Casey and Roe. So look, obviously there's been a lot said about how Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett are not off to a particularly hot start. There's many data points to support this. I don't necessarily feel the need to relitigate them. Let's kind of stipulate that they are not. Justice Gorsuch, who I think by and large, of course, is probably the most successful and the most conservative, I guess, for lack of a better term, of the Trump nominee justices, does himself have some like serious red flags, obviously kind of the Bostock Title VII case being high on the list, but he's had a number of other kind of shaky decisions as well. There was the McGirt case out of Oklahoma, where he basically said the eastern third of Oklahoma is not actually Oklahoma. There was a deportation case, Sessions versus DeMeyer from 2018, where he sided with the liberals. But let's get out of the weeds a little bit here. The question here is, what do we do in the event that Dobbs goes the wrong way to best ensure that this doesn't happen again? And I have a ton of thoughts on this, obviously, but I'll just kind of start by hitting up some themes that I've written about in the past and are probably worth reemphasizing. So I wrote this one article in 2019, actually, back when I was at the Daily Wire, basically saying here are three things that conservatives have to look for future judicial nominations. And I wrote this between the Kavanaugh confirmation and the Barrett confirmation. So it was post-Kavanaugh and pre-Barrett. So the first one, and this really should be obvious, is full spectrum conservatism. Way too often we kind of get in the weeds here. We kind of look at these kind of like libertarian-leaning judges, scholars, whatever. And they talk about how they're proficient on Chevron deference and Chevron doctrine and all these kind of somewhat nerdy, obscure administrative state issues. That's simply not sufficient. We have to kind of get in there and pore over the record to make sure that there is a solid, voluminous, beyond a shadow of a doubt track record that they are actually solid on the bread and butter cultural civilization. I feel so silly that I have to say this 30 years, obviously, after John Sununu promised that David Souter would be okay when they chose David Souter over Edith H. Jones, the stalwart down in Texas. It's crazy that I have to say that, but we do need to obviously vet for legitimate full spectrum conservatism. The second one is stiff resistance to kind of the so-called greenhouse effect. So Linda Greenhouse, the famous New York Times writer, basically said that when you get to DC, it's a monolithic culture for the judges, the Georgetown cocktail parties, they inevitably drift to the left. The way to vet for that primarily is you can look for a few things. One is, I think literally being from the heartland is important. It's not a panacea, okay? Amy Coney Barrett is from the heartland. She's still off to a slow start. But limited time in DC, maybe like a hard cap, literally a hard 5 to 10 year cap on the number of years someone lived in the Beltway, you know, that would disqualify Brett Kavanaugh, for instance, and a lot of DC circuit nominees, I guess. We should also just consider some very crass kind of over and under inclusive measures. Like I would argue, to kind of borrow from President Trump, we should put a hard moratorium on nominating Yale and Harvard law grads until we can figure out what the hell is going on, frankly. And then obviously, if doctrinally, I would argue we should be looking for some inclinations of a strong kind of Clarence Thomas inspired stance on stare decisis, like kind of a strong willingness to decisively change course, to overturn flawed precedents, to return us to a sounder, more substantively just understanding of the Constitution, to kind of use the so-called shadow docket to pursue conservative ends. And obviously, there's the elephant, the third rail in the room, of course, is kind of my side project, the Common Good Originalism Jurisprudential Project. I'm not necessarily expecting that to show up in the vetting process anytime soon, obviously, but there's a lot here. So I'll kind of throw it open to you guys. Do you have any thoughts on what specifically we should be looking for to, as far as if Dobbs goes the wrong way, especially?
Well, I think you've hit on a key aspect, you know, of how we select and vet our judicial nominees. And that is, you know, for the last roughly, I guess, 30 years, we sort of defend and select blank slates. And I think the incentive structure is for these judges to be as blank as possible, you know, to get the nod from as many people as possible. And, you know, I've written about this, but in the beginning of how the judiciary was understood to be, which is sort of this separate, you know, check on Congress, but not a policymaking branch, perhaps that was appropriate, but we've evolved into this scenario where the judges are making all of our cultural choices. They are, you know, Congress has outsourced so many consequential questions to the court that it's almost like we have to vet them for these very specific issues on which, you know, they will decide how we are to be ruled. That should be done by the Congress, but since it's not, you know, this is the reality that we're living in. And so, yeah, I do think, you know, these potential nominees, you know, should be vetted aggressively. When there's a, when a Republican president picks a SCOTUS nominee, it is a rubber stamp exercise. That is the expectation. You know, senators are basically told to fall in line. This is how it's going to be. That has to change. I think senators need to be aggressive in their questioning. I think questions on was Roe v. Wade bad law? That is an acceptable question in my mind that should be asked. Questions should be, you know, asked on all parts of their record, instead of simply saying, okay, this is the president wants, who's the president gets, because the stakes are too high at this point. If Congress isn't going to do their jobs and the courts are, well, these are the questions that we now need to ask. So I think that should happen regardless of how Dobbs goes personally. But I do think it's an essential part of how we move forward with the courts.
I find it hard to improve upon what Josh and Rachel have said. Josh, first of all, I was going to go with the stare decisis. If law is poorly conceived, then why would you ever try to build on poorly conceived law and show deference to something that's incorrectly ruled? It's just insanity to a layman with a non-legal background who's just read a bunch of opinions and used to work in kind of a bankruptcy court context. But it's just absolute insanity to me that you would give deference to poorly ruled cases, period, full stop. I think certainly there are proxies that we can use which serve as both sort of a cultural and jurisprudential check on certain appointees. So I think certainly, you know, not going to an Ivy League law school or a top law school, probably not serving at a big law firm, probably as an undergrad going to a state school, not coming from the Northeast, from the Beltway, from, you know, major city, a metropolitan area on either coast, certainly makes sense to me as well. And then courage is maybe the most important thing. I mean, this obviously is the same for our elected representatives as well. Ask the question, if this person were put in Clarence Thomas's shoes, how would they respond? And I'd also sort of ask, you know, every single time when a Democrat puts up a nominee of the Supreme Court, you know they're going to get it right from the left's perspective 100% of the time. On our side, we have no idea every single time. That cannot happen. There cannot be that chasm between our side and the other side in these decisions. You just cannot afford to get them wrong, precisely because, to Rachel's point, the Supreme Court has as much power as it does because our legislative branch is totally derelict in its duty. Every single vital decision now is punted to the administrative state or to the Supreme Court. Obviously, that balance over the long run has to change. But in the interim, if you assume that every single consequential decision that ought to be in our hands via our representatives is going to go to the Supreme Court, we cannot afford to get any of these picks wrong, period, full stop. And that requires a total root and branch, a reimagining of how we are going to pick these justices. But then that also points to the fact that, of course, it is our legislative branch that has failed in the confirmation process. So it's a systemic problem, which goes to our representatives not actually representing us or the values and principles that they purport to represent.
I'll just jump in and say, as I said earlier, the reason for my setup today is that I'm literally at an event at the National Press Club with the Susan B. Anthony List Young America's Foundation, where I work part-time, and Vice President Mike Pence. And Vice President Pence just gave a speech. And one of the big takeaways for me was that the way that he was talking about this, I think, is really different than the way conservatives have talked about it in the past and in some really meaningful ways. He was talking about this as an industry, a for-profit industry. And to all of the points that everyone just made about needing to have some more boldness in the selection of nominees and the vetting of nominees, I do think there's clearly an indication that conservatives on the right feel like the wind is at their back, that they have alongside advances in the medical field, as Vice President Pence just mentioned, this has really, really put the wind in the sales of the pro-life movement, which is actually, I think, growing beyond just the right. At this point, it's always associated with the conservative movement, and it is part of the conservative movement, but I think it's growing beyond that. So just from my sort of on the ground perspective right now, all I want to do is underscore the point everybody made, that just in the rhetoric that you're hearing from the conservative movement and from major Republican lawmakers right now when it comes to life, there's an ambitiousness and an eagerness to actually talk about something that establishment Republicans really used as red meat occasionally on the campaign trail, never really wanted to do anything about. The rubber is hitting the road right now, and the signs are that the right is rising to the challenge. We'll see. But I think with that, does anyone have, Josh, do you have any final thoughts or anything on that?
I'll add one super quick comment. So Rachel and I have actually messaged about this off camera quite a bit, but one thing that I'll add is, in like the quote unquote, the room where it matters and kind of the proverbial dark kind of cigar filled smoky back room where these judicial nominations sort of things are ultimately decided, there has to be the understanding that nothing is off the table and everything is fair game. And I'm specifically here, I'm thinking about in Gorsuch's record, of course, there's a 2009 case called Castle, where he was sitting on designation on the Ninth Circuit, even 10th Circuit judge, where he basically signed on to an opinion that did the exact same thing that Bostock did 11 years later, where he extended Title VII to the transgender issue. It was right there in the record. People were just too stubborn and were refusing to kind of look at it. They were willfully just looking the other way. So nothing can be off the table. The entire record has to be fair game. But on that note, let's send it right back to you, Emily.
Sounds good. Well, we want to talk now about the Omicron variant, which in the past week has become a huge news story and could be a huge nuisance, actually, and not to go full Alex Jones here. But I will say that when the government and Big Pharma and the corporate America, actually global corporations, were pushing the vaccine in the spring, suddenly we heard about the Delta variant and had to lock down and the mask mandates came back. And now that they're trying to push boosters and the mask mandates are going away, we're talking about, there's been a lot of, I think, panic stoked in the past week with some reckless media conversations and reckless conversations from public officials about Omicron, which is a new variant. As Michael Knowles says, the spoiler here is that there is always going to be a new variant. So if we are thinking about everything that we know so far about Omicron, actually the big story is that we really don't know much. You can hear Francis Collins say that. You can hear Dr. Fauci say that. You can hear the President of the United States say that. We don't know much. We don't know if it's more contagious. We don't know if the cases on average are going to be worse. We don't know that so far. And yet already, we have this as major headline news, inducing panic, making people scared once again. And when people are scared, of course, it's easier to implement all of these policies that are restrictive. So we're once again staring down the barrel of a new variant and policies implemented to deal with it. And we seem to not have learned much about our responses to the Delta variant, the first major variant to challenge us. As COVID was ebbing, I want to open it up to the group just because I do think there's something really important here that if mask mandates are going away and coming back, we're setting ourselves up for this as a perpetual cycle, a perpetual encroachment on our liberties and on our freedoms, on our all of these things. And we'll sort of be living in a permanent state of emergency where first it's coronavirus, then it's the Delta variant, then it's Omicron, and then it's whatever other medical emergency that rises above this low bar. And it keeps us in fear and it keeps us the cover of or under the thumb of these various policies. And we saw that just in the past week as this variant emerged, it has huge implications for federal policy, for state policy. The way that we respond to this is absolutely key. And I'll throw it open to the group for thoughts on that.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the fact that this is like the perpetual state of emergency. It's almost a meme at this point, right? It's like we start to come out of COVID, you know, everybody's done the thing they were told to do, you know, we're moving beyond the pandemic and oh, suddenly, conveniently, you know, there's this like new strand of the virus, new variation, and we all have to lock down again. And I just think it's like, you know, obviously there's a group of people, I think, that want the power and control this gives them to sort of lord over the lives of other people, force people into this like massive compliance regimen. And so much of COVID, I think, you know, and this has happened over time, has stopped being about public health, and it's just about being compliant. And, you know, it's we don't care about the virus anymore. We just care about shaming people. It's literally not, so much of this seems not actually about protecting people, but about just vilifying and shaming people for not doing what they're told. And that is a very dangerous way to live. And I would argue incompatible with the type of government, self-government that we've set up. But I think, you know, sort of that's where we are. And the only way to overcome that is for people just to stop caring. And I think that in and of itself, which is required, also has long-term ramifications for when we have another pandemic, because this is how globalized society, you know, works. You are going to see diseases that spread. At some point, we will see another global pandemic. And I think at this point, all of us who have lived through this are going to be very, very skeptical of being told what to do to stand up against that. And I think that is, unfortunately, a very dangerous way we now live.
I'll just quickly add, I hope that's the case, but that's why I think people on the right and sane people in general, anti-establishment people, cannot give an inch. And I think that already happens way too often on the right, as we just sort of talked about. And I think this is the Omicron variant is a big test of whether we will continue to give the inch that allows the establishment to take the miles.
So I guess I've already been personally a victim of the Omicron panic. I was going to fly to London next week to speak at this Getter conference, a counter conference, I think it was called. And like that whole trip was postponed there because they were going to have like, you know, 10 to 15 MEPs, members of the European Parliament, and they can't like flout the Boris Johnson government quarantine now. So I've personally already been a victim of it. I mean, so you've seen the British government, the European governments in general, the Israeli government, Naftali Bennett, has gone back into, you know, hyperventilating lockdown, terrible look, obviously. I mean, look, it calls to mind, obviously, kind of like the old, like, Einstein, you know, a quote, whether it's apocryphal or not, I think he actually said it, right? Back on the definition of insanity, being like the same thing over and over again, not work. I mean, this, how many times do we need to go through this? I mean, it is just, it is the conceit. You know, Fauci gets on there on national television on the Sunday talk show circuit and talks about how, like, I am the science. If you deny me, you're denying the science. I mean, I don't, Rachel had a great tweet about this. I don't have like enough words to like decry just like the lecherous, just horrific nature of an egomaniac of this sort who can get on television and just willfully through like, I mean, thinking that he's coming down from Sinai with the tablets can just impose on this these draconian, just life altering policies here. And look, I guess here's the thing. I would actually be curious for all three of your thoughts on this. Because we're clearly kind of getting up to a point here where the booster is probably going to be like on some level like required, right? Now, like personally, I got vaxxed in last April. I kind of regret it, to be honest with you. At the time, I thought like the airlines would require it. I had COVID, so I'm pretty confident I already have natural immunity. I'd be curious what the three of you guys think about the booster. Like what would it take to make you get the booster? Because for me personally, I think I probably am okay at this point facing like social stigma, like not being able to go to certain events. I guess like if, you know, if my employers, like in my case, like Newsweek starts having like a hard requirement, even for remote workers like me, maybe that changes the ball game, obviously. But I'd actually be really curious. Like, have you guys thought about like what it would take to get the booster at this point?
The science with a capital S.
Look, I think, you know, so many of us are in the position of, look, like, we did the thing we were asked to do. You know, we had faith in the process. We were like, all right, if this is the thing that's going to get us through COVID, at least in my mind, right? Oh, I want to travel internationally. This is the thing I have to do. We can move on now. And we can't. So it's like, why would I still keep sticking myself with something that's not going to get us through this pandemic? The efficacy of which is always questioned. Like, why would you do that? Why would any sane person making a rational choice do that?
I think it's very clear that there's nothing you can do that will ever keep you in compliance with whatever the diktats are. It's going to be never ending. You know, I wrote for Josh at Newsweek a piece about the fact that it's the Afghanistan of pandemics. We are on a forever pandemic footing, even though this is becoming endemic. Even though if the vaccines are so great, then there shouldn't be any issue over the long run. And by the way, and the one the one kind of wrench to throw in this framework, and I really haven't seen anyone address it, is we have these antivirals that supposedly are showing a lot of promise in development. So what happens if those antivirals really do work as well as the testing would seem to indicate? How can they keep up the charade of preventing you from living your life if you have this magic pill that you can take at early onset that will protect you seemingly from the worst effects of it? I don't know how that's going to play out. I have seen reporting to suggest that they intentionally, it seems, delayed the development of those for some period of time, which calls into question all manner of conspiracy theories as well. And then just one more conspiracy theory wrench to throw in this is the fact that, of course, Dr. Fauci is talking about the fact that they're going to have vaccines potentially in Q1 2022 for those younger than 5 years old. Is that the breaking point? I mean, as a parent of young children, it's certainly beyond a breaking point for me, to the extent to which authorities are going to say you need to inject your two-year-old with something that hasn't been around for more than 2 years at the point of a government gun, or at the point of Dr. Fauci's gun, you know, a health technocrat. That to me, that ought to be the breaking point for Americans, but I don't know, because such a wide percentage of Americans have shown themselves to be compliant and submissive in the face of the science. I saw a poll recently showing that, you know, the scientific community, confidence in the scientific community has actually gone up pretty significantly. And that, you know, that's beyond demoralizing from my perspective, if we're going to live in a free society going, or something resembling a free society going forward.
And with that, I think we're tossing it right back to you, Ben.
All right. So I guess I'll try to segue from that segment to this one, which is that I'm going to call this the Chi variant going forward. It's just utterly enraging that the WHO, obviously skipping the new variant, I guess makes sense. But Chi, clearly, in my view, is just further kowtowing in the face of the Chinese Communist Party. It's the Chinese Communist Party's favored line, essentially, that the WHO is taking. Let's not forget that the Biden administration, one of its first moves was to go back into the CCP colluding WHO. So I'm calling it the Chi variant. In fact, they're all really the Chi variants in reality. And Xi Jinping does not deserve the protection of the WHO. But with that, I want to talk a little bit about something that came up at NatCon 2. I moderated a panel on US-China policy, and it was largely focused on Taiwan. And there was a very spirited debate that took place between Michael Anton, David Goldman, and Michael Pillsbury about sort of what happens if we get into a shooting war with China over Taiwan. And even one step before the question of that debate that I think is really important to emphasize, and I don't think it's really been emphasized, and I'll probably do this in a piece for Joshua Newsweek that I assume would be out early next week, let's say, is something that Jean Kirkpatrick raised in an essay in, I believe, 1990. And I've referenced this before. She sort of has this concept of a normal country in a normal time. And I would suggest right now, we're an abnormal country in an abnormal time. But nevertheless, I think there's a line that's really relevant today, 30 years later. And Kirkpatrick says, it has become more important than ever. And this is, of course, you know, just after sort of the end of the Cold War. It has become more important than ever that the experts who conduct foreign policy on our behalf be subject to the direction and control of the people. We should reject utterly any claim that foreign policy is the special province of special people, beyond the control of those who must pay its costs and bear its consequences. And this gets to something that I think is really important, not discussed enough, that for national security and foreign policy to have any legitimacy whatsoever, the American people need to be read into it. There needs to be buy-in from the American people, whatever the policy is, when it comes to matters that impact American life and limb, abroad of our servicemen, when it comes to potential attacks, ramifications, blowback for Americans on our homeland, when it comes to, of course, the loss of prestige potentially, or the gaining of prestige in terms of fulfilling our obligations, our commitments. And then, of course, you know, more broadly, when it comes to the size, scope, and nature of the threats posed by our adversaries and what that's going to mean for us long term. And I'm speaking sort of in abstract terms here, but I think the issue of Taiwan is absolutely critical because it is sort of the proxy for the entire US versus China competition. Obviously, Taiwan in its own right is essential in any number of ways, including the fact that it is the dominant semiconductor producer of the world. It is a living, breathing rebuke to the idea that the Chinese people could not be a free people potentially. Taiwan is everything that China could be were its people to be freed of the shackles of the CCP. But even setting all of that aside, it's very clear that Xi Jinping views Taiwan as the apple of his eye. It would be his crowning achievement to quote unquote reunify communist China. And there's, you know, potentially a domino theory impact here as well of if Taiwan were to fall under Chinese control, what would that mean for all manner of other nations in Taiwan's orbit? Like if we're talking about the Philippines or Japan or any number of other nations. And then what would it mean if America fails to act or conversely does act in a circumstance where China might engage in a somewhat of a conventional incursion? And China is, of course, doing more than just saber rattling with respect to Taiwan. It's engaged in a massive military buildup. It already boasts a Navy that has more vessels than our Navy, although in any other number of metrics, our Navy is significantly stronger. But all of that aside, the conversation is not even being had. What happens the day that China does engage in an incursion against Taiwan? Or even prior to that, is Taiwan a red line for America in terms of China making a move in terms of trying to take it back? Or what costs ought to be raised? What price ought to be paid or should we create in advance of any such incursion to make it really hard for China to justify doing so? Or is China willing to say at any cost, we're going to try and take it? And then to the extent to which there is this a conventional sort of attack, what is the US response? How far are we willing to go to defend Taiwan? What about our allies? What happens if this ends up involving nuclear weapons? What happens if there's sabotage of our communications, not only abroad, but here at home, or all manner of other knock-on effects and the like? All of these sorts of questions need to be out there for the American people, because this is the start of potentially a massive hot war, not a hot war by other means, but a more conventional, and then in a whole bunch of other asymmetric areas, war with China that involves US life and limb and trillions of dollars in commerce and beyond. And the conversation isn't even being had. And strategic ambiguity has been the nature of the US policy with respect to Taiwan. You know, we have this sort of formal, informal relationship with Taiwan. We don't really have official diplomatic ties, but of course there are representatives that go over and there are representatives of Taiwan who are received in DC. Obviously there are weapon sharing agreements and weapon sales and the like and informal commitments. And then we know that there have been US troops who've been training Taiwanese over the last year as well. But there needs to be an explicit argument about what are all the potential scenarios, even if the US government didn't want to tip its hand one way or the other whatsoever. And Joe Biden, incidentally, has kind of shockingly taken a public position, and it seems like his people have to walk it back every time because it's not clear that it's really kind of the deep state's view of Taiwan. Biden himself has basically said, you know, we're committed to defending Taiwan and removing ambiguity, but it's ambiguous because it's coming from him. And you don't know if that really is the administration's policy, actually. So all of this is to say, this is an issue that could potentially subsume, could potentially dominate and crowd out every sort of other issue that we're dealing with to the extent there becomes a shooting war with communist China. And the conversation isn't even happening. So I was heartened to see that conversation happen at NatCon too. But I also think it's incumbent upon our leaders to be talking about it, because this really could become the seminal issue. I mean, this could be the start of the World War III that we see, even if it's undertaken by other means in other domains in the 21st century. So with that, I just tip it to the group. You know, shouldn't this conversation be happening? Is it an imperative that it be happening? And what should our leaders be saying about U.S.-Taiwan relations in context of the broader conflict, the conflict of this century that we have ongoing with China?
I will just jump in quickly and say I do think the Cold War framing is helpful, because that's what this gets down to at the bottom of the day, is what do we want to allow another superpower to impose its evil worldview on other countries and to start taking up. And this is like getting into exactly the same Cold War calculus, but after we have sort of run the Cold War experiment in Vietnam, in other places of the world, and we've sort of had this test of imperialism and transferring our end of history, Western values, we've run that experiment. There's mixed results. And so now we're reckoning with it in another huge test. You have an evil force that is actually encroaching and is doing it in some very subtle but dangerous ways with like Dalton Road. And that's now the question that we're confronting. And we have to, Taiwan is the start and it's coming up quickly. The test is coming up really quickly.
So I do predict that Xi Jinping will invade Taiwan. I will go on the record of saying that. I don't know exactly when it will happen, but I absolutely predict it will happen. Henry Olsen had a really interesting recent column for the Washington Post about Xi Jinping, actually. And Xi Jinping thought is now officially part of the Chinese school curricula. The Chinese Communist Party has declared Xi to be a historic figure on par with Mao. All that to say, the Belt and Road Initiative, which Ben mentioned, I think that Xi does view himself as kind of a transformative, really kind of like a Napoleon Bonaparte-esque figure, honestly. Reuniting, the Republic of China with the People's Republic of China by means of a cross-Taiwanese Strait invasion really would be the feather in the cap of that. So look, Ben, I was at your NatCon panel. It was one of my favorite panels of the entire conference. Watching Anton and Pillsbury kind of do that like that was deeply interesting. And for the listeners and viewers who were not there, Mike Pillsbury of Hudson and Mike Anton of Hillsdale and Claremont were basically arguing whether if she does actually involve Taiwan, whether we need to go to war and risk kind of a massive conflagration over Taiwan. My card's fully on the table. I'm with Anton. I think that ultimately, if they were to literally do that, I would not start a war. Having said that, what I also personally support is basically arming the crap out of all of like our regional allies in the region with all the relevant kind of missile defense apparatuses. I have been a huge proponent for years of rearming Japan. Japan is not really looking to do that because they have this guilt-ridden conscience, obviously, in a lot of ways from kind of the World War II stuff. And they, as the only country that was the recipient of nuclear weapons, they're not particularly interested in arming themselves. So there's kind of a weird Japanese psychology there. But I don't think that there's anything inconsistent with saying that we should do everything we possibly can in kind of like an Abraham Accords-esque fashion to kind of get our allies in the region to unite against a kind of a joint regional foe. In the Middle East, that's Iran. In the Far East, that's China, of course. But if push comes to shove, personally, I'm not sure that I want the U.S. to go to war with China over Taiwan, in part because I genuinely do not know if the U.S. would win that war. And if we did, it would take a long time and just be horrific.
Yeah, that's the only thing I really have to add is that, I think for so long, our inclination in dealing with China has been to focus on a military strategy, sort of exclusive of all of the other ways in which China is attempting to dominate us, which I would argue is largely like geoeconomic at this point. There's always a military element to this as well. But I think there's been sort of a myopic focus solely on just the issue of Taiwan. What would the US do in a ground war? And I think a lot of those simulations show us losing, to be frank. And so I do think that, just a sort of military focus is not enough. We've said many times on the show before, nothing is going to change with China until we implement a whole of government U.S. policy that is focused on pushing China back, out of our markets, away from our sovereignty. And until we're prepared to do that, I think China looms large on multiple planes, including this one.
Ben, anything that you want to wrap a bow on there real quick?
Yeah. The only thing that I will add is precisely because of the notion of how terrible and all out pseudo conventional war. And I don't think China would want to fight us incidentally in a conventional way, because I think if in a conventional war, we would probably win. But in a non-conventional war, the balance of strength shifts. The precisely the reason we ought to be talking about this is because if American life and limb is going to be under threat at home or abroad, the people better know why decision makers are making the decisions that they're making, or the entire system loses whatever shred of legitimacy it still has. And lastly, just to Rachel's point, I totally agree. China's power is in large part derived from our dealings with China. If we shut off that business, if we shut off those dealings, painful though it may be for us, it poses an existential threat to communist China. And by the way, the fact that Xi Jinping feels a sense of urgency to make this move now, I also think is more a sign of weakness over the long run than strength.
Well, on that note, let's transition to our final thoughts for the week. Anyone want to get us started here?
I can jump in first, just then that way I can stop getting yelled at, which I actually did just get yelled at. So I'll say Ben said something really interesting, which is that he saw a poll about people's sort of trust and faith in the institution of science increasing. And I haven't seen that, but I don't doubt it. And it's the theme that ties everything together, which is that we are being conditioned, not to go full Alex Jones again, but conditioned to have this just irrational trust or need for government control. It's with fear, it's with Omicron, and it's what makes countries, especially smaller countries, less developed countries, more likely to accept the influence of China, of a country like China, where that control is normalized and legal and tolerated, if not actually openly embraced by the people. So all of this ties together in that the sort of major governments of the world want to take more control over people. And I think a lot of that has to do with modern technology, conditioning them to believe that that's what's right and what's good in this very scary globalized society. So we're heading down to a dark path, and we should not forget that what's happening here domestically is part of something much bigger and will have international implications as well.
So I'll just follow up on the Dobbs segment as my final thought. Because I guess what else could I talk about here? So look, I have been among a handful of people who has actually argued that the proper construction of the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment is such that abortion is actually unconstitutional because unborn children are persons under the Equal Protection Clause. But having said that, that is a minority view, even in right of center circles, the predominant view, the view that the justices in the Dobbs case who on the right of center would assuredly adopt is such that, you know, they would take the old Scalia line that the abortion is silent, that the Constitution is silent on abortion, and therefore this is an issue properly for the states. So even from like the left's like worst case perspective here, which is kind of a clean overruling of Casey and Roe, which obviously is the best perspective for folks on our side of this long-running contentious debate, it does amount to kind of just a devolution to the states. It's a very basic point, but a lot of people just are constantly just botching this. And it's usually just willful, right? They're kind of just purposely just miscommunicating. They're shoving out their misinformation into the Twitter sphere, just trying to kind of rile people up. But if Roe versus Wade is overturned, and kind of my theory and the people who agree with me in the 14th Amendment is not adopted, and, you know, for better or for worse, it will not be adopted. I'm telling you that right now. This issue just goes back to the states. And like, honestly, like there probably are five states at the most that I can think of, five red states at the most that would just simply ban abortion from moment to fertilization. I mean, you could think of any number of states that would pass a similar statute to Mississippi, 12 to 15 week abortion ban. Well, you know, like who else has like a 12 week abortion ban? France. A country that is institutionally dedicated to laïcité, to strong, strong separation of church and state and secularism as a national ethos. They have a 12-week abortion ban. So I guess my final thought is just that if Roe and Casey are overturned, you know, my response to the left, and this should all be all of our response to the left, is get a grip. Just get a grip. Literally all that would do is realign America's abortion policies closer with that of Western Europe, as opposed to North Korea and the Chinese Communist Party.
But I think, you know, it also, the point should be made too, that, you know, this is actually what state sovereignty is for, particularly on these questions of, you know, the intersection of morality and theology and public health and medical science. The courts have no business making those choices. You know, those need to be revisited constantly by the voters themselves. And I think Amoltha Parr, I can't remember which circuit court he's on, but he made a very compelling case for this point of view I think it was a concurrence, I think he wrote earlier this year. And it's worth reading in full, because I think this is one of the biggest arguments that can be made against judicial supremacy over cultural questions. These are rightly left to the people in their communities to make these decisions. But I think, you know, the strand to me that pulls all these segments together more broadly is that, you know, the right, and we come back to this theme a lot, but the right is facing unprecedented challenges. You know, we've talked about kind of the onslaught that COVID and COVID policies have brought to the challenge of big tech, to the emergence of China, to even the pro-life movement on which we've relied, you know, potentially not seeing us through in ways that we thought it would. And this requires you know, a lot of new and creative thinking, which is what we are trying to do, I think, here on this show, but each of us do sort of in our own capacities more generally. And I do think that that's what the conservative movement is for. And that's what our conservative traditions have always told us, is that we can't rest on our laurels. We constantly have to be pushing the envelope on these questions and thinking of new ways to address new issues as they emerge. And that's, I think, a constant theme, you know, of what the right should be doing. And this comes to mind because I was told yesterday that, the conservative legal movement has produced so many goods. So why can't we just focus on that? Well, that is true. The conservative legal movement has been a force for good, but we always need to be pushing the envelope and never settling and always pushing for more. So that's where I fall on these questions.
I guess to me, what sort of ties the segments together in a lot of respects is that tyranny is what is common throughout the history of mankind. The concentration of power in the hands of a few is commonplace throughout mankind. And whether it's public health authorities, whether it's the big tech companies, whether it is Supreme Court justices and others within our political establishment, at the end of the day, these kind of bureaucracies, and that's really what they are, or I guess you could say oligarchies in some ways, always exist to perpetuate and propagate and promote their own power. And we are sort of the revolutionaries, the radicals, when you think about in the broader context of history, the fact that, you know, the norm is the kind of China model that we see today, a China model that our elites increasingly emulate and with whom our elites increasingly collude. So, you know, I think what it comes down to ultimately is, and one of the reasons that we have all opened ourselves up in one way or another to a desire to wield political power when we have it in furtherance of these ends is a realization that it is absolutely imperative in the one area where there actually is some representation for us to actually push back and use that power because we're dealing with a tyrannical onslaught. But of course, much more broadly, we need to effectuate, and this is the long-term cultural issue, we sort of need the counter long march through all of our institutions and starting in our society, starting in our homes and our schools and our communities, a push to change our culture such that we are the free people that we ought to be, rather than a people who could be pounded into submission by all of these forces, that we actually have an elite that is truly elite and actually representative of our country as well, and not an elite that deplores our country, an internationalist, in effect, anti-American, Wilsonian progressive elite. But that requires a long-term, decades-long, probably century-long march of our own. But it starts, of course, with what we can do with what we have today, and that is some level of political power and the fact that still roughly half the country is relatively common sense. So, reason for optimism, but also certainly these forces are arrayed against us. They're very powerful. They control the commanding heights of society, and we face greater foreign threats than maybe we've ever faced in the history of this country. So it's a challenging time, but also a time of great opportunity.
All right. Well, on that uncharacteristically, perhaps white-pilled note, we're going to call it a wrap right there. On behalf of Ben, Emily, and Rachel, I am Josh Hammer. We will see you at the next NatCon Squad.